welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney, a podcast for educators who are interested in teaching. I'm a primary teacher and teacher educator, and a book I wrote about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, was published by Routledge. You can listen to or download hundreds of previous episodes of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. You can email me by writing to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. You can follow me on Twitter, where I use the handle @InsideEd. Last October, Educate Together, the equality-based school patron, announced that its new chief executive officer to replace Paul Rowe in February 2020 would be Dr. Eimear Nolan. This week, Eimear Nolan took up her position as CEO designate, and on this week's podcast, I'm delighted to bring you an interview with Eimear. Although Eimear Nolan has just completed time working on the Migrant Teacher Project at Merino Institute of Education, she has previously worked for Educate Together as Second Level Project Manager, as Head of Education and Network Development, and as Chief Operating Officer. She is a qualified post-primary teacher, and she oversaw the opening of the first Educate Together post-primary schools in 2014. She is particularly interested in the school experiences of young people from minority ethnic backgrounds. You'll like this podcast if you're interested in the challenges of providing education that is equality-based and in how the teaching profession can become more diverse in its makeup. You'll also find the podcast informative about the role of school patron and about the challenges of establishing a new school. When I met up with Eimear Nolan last week, I first asked her to outline her own career in education to date.
I loved school, so I decided I wanted to be a teacher, like so many teachers, and I decided I wanted to do PE teaching because I liked sport.
How young were you now when you say you decided to be a teacher?
I'd say maybe around fourth year, so transition year. We had a transition year in my school way back then, which was great actually for giving you space to think. My choice at the time was either Limerick, what was Thomond College at the time, or England. And I chose England because bizarrely at that time, you didn't have to pay fees if you went to England, whereas you still did in Ireland. So I went over, did PE in maths in Strawberry Hill, like lots of other Irish people. And then from there, I taught a little bit in London. I went travelling. And from that time, I got quite involved in English as a foreign language teaching because it was very convenient for travelling. And I did work in some schools, but then I also taught adults and I taught in businesses and so on. And then I spent about 10 years in Portugal where I ran a language school where we taught a range of languages and we had some relationships with schools, but again, kind of adults as well. And then I came back to Ireland and I did my MEd in UCD. And that was probably the first point at which I realised, okay, I actually enjoy education. This is where I want to be. I kind of, you know, rediscovered my passion for all things education and in particular that link between education and equality, education and society. And from there, then I was offered a scholarship to do my PhD in UCD. So I stayed, not particularly because I was desperate to do a PhD, because I didn't really know, having been in different places and kind of in a range of different settings, exactly what I wanted to do. And the role in Educate Together as second level project manager came up during that time. And I kind of, a light went on and I said, yes, that's what I want to do. Because I suppose I would have been to quite a progressive secondary school myself in Ireland, although of course you don't realise that at the time your school is just your normal environment. But having gone away and seen other things and come back, I kind of felt that there were things that I wanted to do, if you like, in schools here, rather than just going into a teaching job. And the Educate Together role kind of really gave me the opportunity to do that.
And what topics did you study in the MEd and the PhD?
In the MEd, I suppose it was the usual range of things. There were some choices, so I kind of emphasised in particular the sociological modules and equality modules and so on. Language as well, because obviously I'd been working in the English language area for a while. And that led me then from my research from my MEd, I looked at English and additional language in post-primary schools because, you know, having worked in the UK and different places where EAL was quite well developed, here it was in its very early stages. So just looking at what was going on in post-primary schools, and again, from a kind of an equality perspective. And then for the PhD, I suppose I became very interested in that relationship between ethnicity and educational experience, kind of in a two-way thing. So, you know, what difference did it make if somebody's from a minority ethnic background to their educational experience, but also what kind of identity formation goes on in a school setting for somebody around their ethnicity. So my PhD research looked at the experiences of young people from Chinese, Vietnamese and Filipino backgrounds in secondary schools. And I also did a huge range of, it was a structured PhD in UCD, and I was full-time for the first year because I had a scholarship. So I did about 10 kind of postgraduate modules while I was also starting the research, which were really broad and which I really, really enjoyed. It may have been the longest PhD in history. Well, probably not in history, but in the end, because I then went part-time and took the role in Educate Together, it took me 9.5 years to finish my PhD. But I did, and I'm delighted now.
And you talked then about taking on the role of project officer for second level in Educate Together, because initially Educate Together was purely a primary school phenomenon.
It was, yeah. Now, funny enough, one of the first things I did when I came back to Ireland was look up Educate Together, because I would have heard of it as a child. My parents would have been involved in the campaign for the Dorky School project back in the 70s, but it didn't open in time for me. So I went to a different primary school. So I would have been kind of aware at a distance of Educate Together. And when I came back and had a look and was thinking, do I want to go and teach in a school? I had an idea that that might be the kind of school I might want to teach in. And I realised there were no secondary schools, even though I'd kind of assumed that there would be by now. So I kind of kept an eye on it. And there were campaigns at that time. Different parents in different parts of the country had mounted campaigns for schools, but they hadn't been successful. But then it took kind of a philanthropic funder to offer some investment towards the second level project for it to really get off the ground. And that was the role that I saw advertised that I applied for. So it was, you know, the job was to establish the project from scratch. So, you know, developing the curriculum and the model, lobbying for change, I suppose, to get sanction for the first school, and then developing kind of policy in the area and so on.
Yeah, and I do want to come back to that topic because I think it is so interesting. You know, where do you start setting up a whole new sector in second level education? But first of all, I want to just touch on the project that you worked on most recently here in Marino, actually, and it was the Migrant Teacher Project. What exactly is that project? What does it involve?
Okay, so it supports teachers from immigrant backgrounds to continue their professions in Ireland. I suppose we'd all be aware that there is kind of a lack of diversity, and increasingly aware that there is a lack of diversity in the teaching profession in Ireland. I mean, if you look at the census data, we're approaching 20% in terms of the number of children of student age who would describe themselves as something other than white Irish. But within the teaching profession, we're still pretty much at 100% really white Irish. And then, of course, you know, we'd all probably be aware of teachers who have come over, who have looked to maybe have their qualifications registered with the Teaching Council and sought employment, and it's very difficult. I mean, I know myself, my own qualification was from the UK, and it took me 2 years just to gain my Teaching Council registration when I came back, and that's as a local who would know the system.
And is that the main challenge, the Teaching Council registration, or are there other challenges that teachers who are qualified abroad face?
No, there are a range of challenges. And in fact, I think when we started the project, people might have assumed that registration was the big barrier. And it is a difficult process, certainly. But there are other barriers as well. I mean, I suppose any migrant who, you know, arrives in a new country, straight away, you don't really know the system. Your qualifications lose a little bit of their value, you know, when you travel. And that's true in teaching as well. But also, I suppose, employment practices. We did quite a detailed needs analysis when we started the project, and that showed, yes, registration is a barrier. The cost of registration is a barrier, needing to translate documents and, you know, get documents from universities from years ago. But in terms of employment, you know, there is still, I suppose, a preference for many principals that they would offer employment to somebody who they have a recommendation for, and not just a recommendation for, but a recommendation from another principal. And that's very, very difficult to get if you're not from here, if you don't know anybody in schools. So, yeah, it's, I mean, I remember one of the comments from one of the teachers we had in our focus groups that, you know, he actually used the phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And we all know that expression, but it seems to be particularly true in the education sector. So I suppose for the bridging, for what we wanted to do was to support people through that process, give them the information they need around the registration process, also advice and just a little bit of hand-holding, because it's very demoralising when you're trying to get into the system and you're not really getting anywhere. So just, I suppose, linking people up with each other for support. But then the core of it is our bridging programme. So this bridging programme provides people with a little bit of additional knowledge, you know, even around the different bodies here. What does the NCCA stand for? You know, what's the curriculum like in my subject in this country? But school experience as well, because getting, you know, across the threshold of a school is the big challenge. You know, we had teachers who were offering to volunteer, but of course schools are very reluctant to take somebody in off the street
who, even as a volunteer,
even as a volunteer, very hard. So we added the school experience element after completing the needs analysis, because we could see that really it was contacts and time in school that people wanted and needed as much as that additional knowledge.
And was it that schools didn't trust the qualifications, or were they concerned about child protection matters, or what was the problem, do you think, in terms of, you know, like it's unusual to turn away an internship person that you don't have to pay for?
Yeah, it is, although it wouldn't be the normal practice, I suppose, in schools. You know, you might have parents volunteering, but it wouldn't often go beyond that. And we did do focus groups with principals, and these were principals who were very interested in the whole area of migrant teachers, who some of them would have had people, you know, deliberately sought out people from overseas to work in their schools. But they still would have expressed a kind of a hesitance to take somebody without that recommendation from another Irish principal, if you know, they were being honest. And they didn't really go into detail as to why that was. But yes, I'm sure it was child protection and all of those matters, especially at primary level. I think there is a really strong desire to keep the children safe in the first instance. Yeah.
Are the challenges particularly great, say, for teachers who are EU resident or EU qualified versus those who are qualified from outside the EU?
Well, I suppose from a registration point of view, all applications are treated under the same EU directive, whether they come from EU citizens or people who qualified elsewhere. So in theory, it's a level playing field from that regard. There's a range of people out there with different levels of resources as well. So, you know, if you're arriving and your English is very, very good, or English is your native language, and you happen to have maybe some family contacts here or somebody who knows the system, you're in a better position than maybe somebody, you know, for whom you're still getting your English fully up to scratch. You don't necessarily know anybody here. So it's not really about EU, non-EU as much as your level of contact in Ireland. And then people can be lucky as well. Sometimes people who were parents manage to find a school experience placement through their own children, or through their own children's school, or through neighbours and so on. I mean, it's early days. We did have a very good success rate from our first bridging program. So certainly more than half of the people who completed the first bridging program are now in employment, in what we'd call suitable employment, you know, maybe a maternity leave contract rather than just subbing. But yeah, it's early days to say whether some teachers are finding it harder or easier than others.
And I know you've moved on from it now, but is there anything you've learned from your time with the Migrant Teacher Project that, you know, could inform how it could be improved in the future?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think we're learning all the time. It's brand new. So myself and Rory, we're constantly learning how to improve things. I mean, we're lucky now that we managed to get some funding to continue the project for a further 3 years. And we added additional components to it in that funding application. So, for example, we identified that support that teachers give each other is very important. So, you know, we'll be setting up a kind of a slightly more formal network for immigrant teachers, so that people can come together and just build confidence and share knowledge and so on. But also working with schools. So the difficulty that teachers have had getting into schools, one of the ways we'd like to try and overcome that is by developing a network of schools who want to lead integration in this area, because there were individuals and principals who were very interested to get involved. So, you know, a component of the next 3 years will be developing that network and giving schools an opportunity to get involved in supporting teachers, because it's in their interests as well. You know, there are huge benefits to having a diverse teaching staff. So, you know, why wouldn't they want to get involved?
So moving on to your new position now, which is as incoming CEO of Educate Together. Just before you start, how are you feeling at this stage?
Excited, yeah. Obviously a little bit nervous. It's a big job. It's one that I'm really privileged to have, and I'm excited to get started. I officially start next Monday, and then there's a short handover period. But, you know, I was there before for quite a long time, so I'm looking forward to, there's fantastic people in the Educate Together network, so I'm really looking forward to getting back involved and working with those people.
And the fact that you were there already means you know some of the people you're going to be engaging with anyway.
Yeah, although, of course, the network is growing so quickly. You know, even in the 2.5 years since I left, I think we've an additional 15 schools. So, you know, there are 15 brand new organisations to get to know, which is great. But yeah, it's...
And is the development at this stage now mostly in the post-primary area, or are there still new primary schools starting?
Oh, still new primary schools as well. So, you know, I think at the moment there are campaigns ongoing for three new primary schools that will open in 2020. And I think Educate Together has applied for the patronage of all three of those. So, you know, we're up to 92 primary schools and 17 post-primary schools. I mean, the growth looks faster at second level because proportionally, I suppose they would have grown more quickly in the first 10 years of the second level schools, if you like, or the first 6 years. It's only 6 years since the first one opened, than in the early days of the primary schools. But that's more about the nature of the demand now and the systems that are there for kind of awarding patronage of new schools than anything else.
And when you think of further expansion of the sector now, do you look across the country and kind of say, oh, we have a gap in this geographical area? Or how do you think about it or get your head around, you know, where the opportunities are for new primary or secondary schools?
I suppose personally, I would be very focused on the six counties where there are still no Educate Together primary or post-primary schools. So sometimes people see the growth in Educate Together and think, oh, sure, you know, there's schools everywhere now. There aren't, you know, so Leitrim, Roscommon, Cavan, Monaghan, Longford and Tipperary, still no Educate Together schools. And, you know, it really is about choice. If we go back to the organisation's charter, it's about making equality-based education as available as any other model. So yes, I would be personally very focused on those gaps. But I suppose the demand comes from all kinds of different places. So if you can't access equality-based education for your child, it doesn't matter to you whether you're in County Leitrim or whether you're in Drumcondra. If there aren't enough places, there aren't enough places.
Educate Together has been in existence for over 40 years at this stage. But when it started, it was nothing like the organisation it is today in terms of its infrastructure. It was much more of an ad hoc kind of voluntary organisation. How has it evolved over its existence?
It's funny, actually. I was talking to some of the people who were involved in founding some of the early schools just yesterday. I mean, it is very much still a network of activists and volunteers. So some of the people who were involved in founding the first schools, you know, they're still on boards of schools. When we open new schools, we're on the phone to them looking for them to help out. So it's kind of a family feeling to it still. But we were kind of agreeing that although a lot has changed and, you know, it's wonderful to have a professional organisation with so many dedicated professionals who are very well qualified with a developed ethical education curriculum and I suppose more written down material about what Educate Together is and what Educate Together does. On the other hand, some of the challenges, you know, are very similar. So they were talking about things like, you know, knocking on doors to try and find a little space to move their school into when they had to move out of the scout den or, you know, whatever. Buildings is still a huge issue. Obviously now, if the Department of Education sanctions a new school, a building is built, sometimes immediately, sometimes after a number of years. But, you know, the policy is that a building will be provided. But there is actually still quite a large responsibility on the part of parents and local activists and local councils to try and find that space. You know, we're quite poor at planning still, planning for population growth in Ireland. So that, you know, if a developer builds, whatever, 1,000 houses, there's no obligation on anyone to provide a site for a school. So very often the Department of Education is coming in after the fact, trying to look for land for a school when really we all knew it was going to be needed. So yeah, there's a lot of catching up to do there.
But at least the department is coming in now, whereas in the past, particularly Educate Together would have relied on a grassroots local organisation and it started from there with very little top-down intervention in the past.
Yes, I mean, you know, the system up to 2009 was that if any organisation gathered, it was basically 17 names. If you had 17 junior infants, you could apply for sanction to open a new school. And, okay, so that wasn't always successful, but, you know, that was the policy that it didn't matter what the population was. It didn't, if you had the numbers, you could at least apply for the patronage of a school. So the system's now changed in that it's very much focused on population growth. So the department has a kind of a GIS population system that it looks at and it decides where are the children who need schools. And it only sanctions the opening of schools in those areas, which does make sense. And obviously, you know, we need to be planning for that growth. But it doesn't help the people of Leitrim, Roscommon, Cavan, Monaghan, because, you know, the population isn't growing at that rate in those areas. And yet there is a deficit there in terms of people being able to choose an education which is not kind of religious.
When Educate Together was established in the 1970s, the goal was the four principles of being child-centred, co-educational, multi-denominational, which is now equality-based, and democratically run. And at the time, that was groundbreaking. But is there a sense now that many other schools have moved into this direction, you know, would claim to be child-centred, they are co-educational in many cases and so on? Is it time to reconceive of Educate Together's mission?
It's an important question that I think the organisation has to be asking itself all the time. And it's certainly true that all schools have, you know, a greater equality focus than they used to. All schools have had to and wanted to become, you know, more inclusive in the broadest sense now. I'm not just talking about inclusion of children with additional needs. And that's great. And there's fantastic practice happening in lots of different schools around the country. I suppose for Educate Together, you know, it's ingrained in the charter. It's written down in your governing documents of your school that you must provide equality of access and respect for every child, regardless of their background. So, you know, we're a long way, I think, both in Educate Together and outside Educate Together, from really achieving an equality-based education for every child. You know, if we think about children with disabilities, children with additional needs, children from traveller backgrounds, you know, there will be good stories of inclusion in different schools around the country. And then there is information that tells us that we're not there yet. So I suppose we'd always be striving to be ahead of the curve. In terms of second level, for example, you know, it's a logical extension of the primary model in that we teach ethical education to all children, which includes elements of, you know, developing critical thinking and encouraging children to become activists, you know, for equality in their communities. And there's obviously great scope for that at second level. But the big challenge at second level is to be truly learner-centred. So to look at the learner in front of you and place them at the centre of their education in a system which is still quite exam-dominated. So, yes, it's a challenge at primary level. It's maybe a greater challenge at post-primary level. And I don't think anyone is there yet. So there's plenty more work to do.
So in your view, what does equality-based education look like at either primary or secondary level?
Starting at second level, there's some kind of visible signs with the new second level schools whereby, for example, you know, students are calling teachers by their first names. They're not obliged to wear uniforms. So, you know, when you arrive at the school, those are the kinds of things that you see. But what you would have to see then at a kind of a deeper level, at a curriculum level, is, you know, just exactly what we're talking about. So in order to be equality based, a curriculum has to be learner centred, because every child brings their own needs and their own background to the classroom. And that needs to be recognised, not just in terms of their comfort and their happiness, but also in terms of their learning. So, you know, there'd be a lot more cross-curricular learning to recognise the fact that children learn in different ways, and that, you know, connected learning is better for most children, not just children with additional needs, but for most children. The ethical curriculum, like as I mentioned, also takes on an additional level of critical thinking, so that you're really encouraging young people to think about society, think about their place in society, and to take action where they see inequalities. At primary level, again, you know, schools are different. So there are 109 schools in the Educate Together network now, and they're all doing different things. They're not all the same. They're all serving different communities. So again, to be equality based, you know, you need to be meeting the needs of your community, whatever that community is. So each school is different.
When you're promoting equality based education, is it possible to do that without stereotyping particular groups of students?
Yeah.
To say, if you want to identify needs of a particular group, how can you treat them equally without stereotyping that group?
Well, isn't that the absolute ongoing challenge for anybody interested in equality-based education? I teach a module in UCD, which is entitled Equality and Social Justice and Children's Learning. And that's exactly the issue that we struggle with. And it's right that it's a struggle. It should be a struggle. Because on the one hand, we are all aware that there are certain groups, and, you know, I use that word advisedly, who don't do as well in education as other groups. And we have to be conscious of that. And we have to explore, now, is there a reason why that's happening that is particular to that group? Usually we then find that actually it's nothing to do with the group themselves. It's to do with our educational institution and how it is not providing an environment for certain people like that. But there's a huge danger in that investigation that we categorise people who don't necessarily want to be categorised. And we have to recognise the fact that as teachers and education leaders, we are generally coming from a a white middle class local background, and we are imposing, you know, our idea of what is right for people very often on people with less power. So it's an ongoing struggle to recognize where inequalities might be existing, explore them in a sensitive way without further, I suppose, you know, reifying categories or categorizing people in a way that they don't want to be categorized, and then to adapt your environment to ensure that everyone can meet whatever their potential is in every way as well. You know, I suppose in academia, you'd be talking about intersectionality and making sure that, you know, in my own research as an example, where I was working with children from different Asian backgrounds, it was really interesting because, you know, Asia, it's an enormous continent with more than a third of the world's population. And yet in education, we seem to be comfortable enough with talking about, and I'm using my fingers here for inverted commas, Asian students, as if there was such a thing as an Asian student. It's such a strongly held category. So I suppose I was interested in getting underneath that and seeing, why is that? You know, what is it about this particular group that we seem so happy to generalize? And is there, you know, are there patterns? And what is the experience of those students? And what I suppose was interesting was, I mean, I actually, the title of my thesis in the end was, "They Call You Chinese When You're Not," because that was the kind of message that was coming through from the children, either the third generation Chinese children who were fed up with people telling them they weren't Irish because they didn't look Irish, but also from not just the Vietnamese children, but the Filipino children as well, who didn't identify in that, you know, stereotypical Asian student way. And yet teachers, because I interviewed teachers as well, and parents, teachers did hold very stereotypical, expectations for these students. And of course, the consequence of that were positive for some, but very negative, for example, for children who maybe had undiagnosed learning difficulties that had been overlooked because it had been assumed that this was a good student who was going to be quiet. And also very negative consequences for, you know, I can think of a couple of Filipino girls, for example, who, you know, they had been fairly, you know, sporty, the stereotypical tomboy type students in the Philippines. And they had come here and they had found that that identity just didn't work in an Irish context. And they were being categorized as good students, quiet students in a way that just didn't suit them at all. And you know, it was quite problematic for some of them. And then, of course, you know, the ways in which that ethnic identity overlapped with social class were really interesting. So, you know, attributes that the teachers were, I suppose, categorizing as maybe Filipino, for example, you know, if you dug into that a little bit, actually it was about the class differences between the children who were coming into the school and the school's kind of natural catchment area, whereby you might have middle class immigrants in a fairly working class school. But there's just really, really rich and valuable identity work going on there, which I think gives really interesting insights into exactly the question that you asked. You know, the way that we do tend, we love to categorize, and especially in a way, people who are interested in nurturing every child's identity, it's to get that balance right. You know, I suppose we're talking about, you know, culturally responsive teaching here. The way to try and understand the background of all your students as well as you possibly can, but without imposing your own idea of what their, you know, cultural background is or their particular identity might be.
And is this a dilemma that's faced by people internationally, or has any education sector or any education system in any country kind of cracked this and kind of said, yeah, this is a place that we can learn from?
I don't know if a system has, and I don't think it's particular to education. I think this is what's going on more broadly in societies across the world. You know, with an increase in globalization, an increase in migration, people are, you know, asking these questions, certainly around ethnicity. But also, you know, if you really want to look at equality in society, you're going to find that regardless of the best will in the world, if we go on ignoring really fundamental underlying inequalities, then you're just going to perpetuate the system that is here. And education systems can be part of unpacking that system and helping us to see those inequalities, or they can also be part of just perpetuating those inequalities and, you know, I suppose, privileging those who are already privileged. You know, at the core of it for me is this notion that education is a meritocracy, when there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that that is true. Actually, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that education does just perpetuate inequality. And that's international. That's not particular to the Irish context. And at the same
time, despite the Leaving Cert and all we say about it being, you know, anonymous and so on.
Yeah, well, I'm not somebody who's ever said that the Leaving Cert was fair. So although I know we do like to hang on to that notion, the statistics just don't bear that out. So,
Are the attendance at grind schools?
No, and all of the other ways in which, you know, those who have privilege will hang on to their privilege, you know, and that's not to criticise anyone who does that, and that's just what we do. I mean, one of the interesting things is if you look at good practice in terms of equality for, say, for example, children with additional needs, it's the same as good practice for children from minority language backgrounds and the same as good practice for children from disadvantaged backgrounds. You know, so there, I think there is a model that emerges regardless of what country you look at, regardless of what school type you look at. And it is about educating children together. It is about, I suppose, educating children to look at those inequalities themselves. It is about recognizing difference, not ignoring it, not pretending that we're all in a meritocracy and if we all work hard, we're all going to get there. You know, actually asking the hard questions. And children are, you know, really, really good at, you know, looking at those questions critically. They have a really keen sense of fairness. So if you start those conversations early, you know, that's where the answers are going to come from, for sure.
Yeah, and does Educate Together look beyond Ireland in terms of looking for, you know, systems that would be that it could learn from, or, you know, other structures that could be helpful to inform it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, the advantage of the growth of the network is we have a large number of education professionals working in the network, all of whom are, you know, constantly learning. So, yes, people do look abroad and look at other school models in Ireland as well to develop. Again, I think the advantage is you always have that really clear objective within the charter. So, you know, that's what unites us. That's what drives us, is the desire to provide equality-based learner-centred education. And you can take from anywhere in terms of learning for that. Just, I suppose, in the last couple of years, we've been involved in an Erasmus Plus funded project with education organisations in Lithuania, Italy and France. So, you know, around developing resources in ethical education for teachers. So that meant seeking out organisations with similar aims who are already working in the area and working with them. That was a really valuable project. Educate Together also has a kind of a sister organisation in the UK now, which has established four Educate Together primary schools in England. And that's an interesting development because you learn a lot about the model when you try and implement it in another jurisdiction, especially a jurisdiction as monitored, if you like, and measured as the UK system, where you've got Ofsted knocking on the door after 12 months and, you know, asking certain questions.
And is it called Educate Together?
Yeah, there are four Educate Together primary academies.
But it's not linked to the Irish Educate Together?
There is a relationship between the two organisations, but they are not Irish Educate Together schools, if you like. But that there's huge scope there for learning between the two systems. Of course, they have the benefit of being brand new and doing everything for the first time, and that brings huge enthusiasm and initiative and new ideas.
I'm sure they probably learn a lot from your organisation.
Yeah, and it's a great exchange.
Educate Together acts as a patron for many schools. What does the role of patron involve for an organisation like Educate Together?
So I suppose there are legal responsibilities. The role of the patron is defined in the Education Act. The nuts and bolts of it are that you appoint the board of management and that the board of management are accountable to the patron for upholding the ethos. So, you know, that sounds relatively simple. It's obviously a historical construct, a historical structure, and Educate Together adopted it at a time when all of the patrons or trustees in the country would have been either bishops or other types of religious organisations, with the exception, obviously, of the VECs at the time or the ETBs, who have kind of different legal structures binding them. But I suppose Educate Together as a patron would aim to be a democratic organisation. So the difference between Educate Together as a patron, Educate Together is a company limited by guarantee, it's a charity, but it's also a membership organisation. So policy, the patron's policy is set by the members. So the schools are all members of the patron. So say, for example, that the policy might be that there might be a policy around enrolment policies, because that is an area where patron has particular legal responsibilities. And that's been quite controversial in Educate Together over the years, because while first come, first served was traditionally the policy, you know, there is recognition that favours people who have knowledge and information. So I suppose there's been a move to change enrolment policies in Educate Together, which stretches, you know, long back much further than the current or the recent admissions bill. But yeah, so taking that as an example, to change policy on enrolment policies in Educate Together, members can bring motions to the AGM and they will be debated, and it will be decided that, for example, as it was decided, I think 4 or 5 years ago at an AGM, that we need to look at first come first served enrollment policies and I suppose test them for equality purposes and see what is the best way forward. I mean, one of the, just while we're on the subject of enrollment policies, that is a big challenge for Educate Together schools who want to be equality based, but then they see that there might be 10 or 15 times as many applicants for places in the school than they can offer. And so what an enrollment policy becomes in that circumstance is actually an exclusion policy. You know, it's a question of deciding who are we not going to let in. And that's a real struggle for a board of management who really want to do the right thing. Whatever.
And what is the policy at the moment? Is it still first come, first served?
No, well, first come, first served used to be one of the options for schools. I suppose the board of directors has developed a number of, you know, pre-approved options for enrollment policies, and that used to include first come, first served, which again, historically was about recognising the fact that people would travel to access this kind of education. But yeah, I suppose there are now schools can adopt a lottery-based policy, which basically it's a properly managed lottery. The names go into the hat and the lottery decides who's going to get the places.
But that's a disadvantage then for anyone who has siblings in the school already. And
well, no, most schools, a sibling policy is usually because it's seen as child-centred and it's seen as family-centred and also environmentally and for other reasons. You don't want families travelling to three and four schools unnecessarily. So a sibling policy would normally be the first line of most policies. But after that, you might be looking at a lottery. You might be looking at a catchment area because certainly any new schools that have been opened in recent years, the Department of Education and Skills are imposing requirements around offering access to children living near the school first, which is very good and proper. And there was the option of a catchment area policy in Educate Together before that happened as well. But yeah, I suppose the difficulty is the oversubscription. You know, when you're turning people away, it's always going to be very hard to come up with a policy that is actually fair. You don't want to disadvantage anyone who's moved into the area. You don't want to disadvantage anybody who just doesn't have the knowledge to know that you're supposed to fill in this form on this date or get the name down or whatever it is. But really the answer has to be to have more school places so that the balance of school types that's on offer is about right, so that nobody is turning away too many people.
What will your work as CEO of Educate Together, what will that role involve?
Okay, so it's a membership organisation. So the CEO is appointed by the board of directors and the board of directors are in turn appointed by the members at AGM. So effectively, I was laughing at my son who goes to an Educate Together primary school. And when I told him I was going to be the CEO of Educate Together, he said, oh, does that mean you'll be Sally's boss? You know, his school principal. I said, no, quite the opposite. It means I'll be working for her because as CEO, I manage the national office staff who work for the members. You know, we're appointed by the members. But no, I suppose effectively it's about bringing together the different roles that Educate Together has. So Educate Together, as you already said, is a school patron, and that brings with it a whole set of legal responsibilities. It's also a registered charity, which again, there's a whole set of requirements around that. It's a school network. It's a grassroots movement. You know, it's a number of different things to different people. So I would see the role of the CEO as bringing all of that together and focusing everyone, I suppose, on the charter, on the Educate Together charter, which provides a very clear vision for what it is that the organisation is aiming for. And that is equality-based education for every child, which means not just more school places being available so that everyone can access this model of education. It's also about ensuring that the schools that are there are truly equality-based. So as the network has grown, you know, it's doubled in size in the last 10 years. It's growing quite rapidly now. There's certainly a need for consolidation, for better maybe communication across the network. We have, you know, a number of different school types now, not just primary and post-primary, but within post-primary we'd have community schools, we'd have community colleges, we'd have voluntary secondary schools, and at primary level we'd have schools that are members of whom we are the patron. We'd also have schools who have their own patron. So, you know, it's quite a diverse network. So in terms of growth, we want to make sure that everyone's communicating, everyone's on the same page. And then, of course, the other part of it is making sure that more people can access Educate Together schools.
And why would some of the second level schools be voluntary, and why would some be a community college and some be community school?
Yeah, well, I suppose when we established the second level project, there was no reason why. There might have been an assumption at the beginning that the schools would be voluntary because the primary schools are voluntary. But then at that time, all primary schools were voluntary. There was no such thing as an E2B primary school then, whereas at post-primary level, there were three and more school types. So we were kind of, what we said, platform agnostic. At the beginning, we said, as long as we can deliver on the charter, so deliver education that is equality-based, learner-centred and so on, then we don't mind what type of a school it is. There are advantages and disadvantages to all the different models at post-primary level. And we're actually delighted that we have a number of voluntary secondary schools, but that also we have worked in partnership with ETBs, both in community colleges and in community schools, because there's huge benefit to that in terms of sharing knowledge and information, and also in terms of resources, because obviously ETBs have state resources that voluntary patrons don't have. So
you've mentioned a lot about the volunteers in Educate Together, but how many full-time staff does Educate Together have?
Anywhere between maybe 15 and 20 at any given time. It's a lot of work for a small number of people. So if you think of a comparable patron, such as whether it's an ETB, for example, they would have obviously a lot more staff to serve.
Education and training boards.
So, yeah, so, I mean, 15 staff members when there are 109 schools of different types is a very small number. I mean, we've been lucky in that we've attracted fantastic people to work in the national office, and they work very hard. But there is, I suppose, a limit to how far those resources can stretch. So it's always a kind of a juggling act to prioritise what needs doing at any given time.
And you've kind of touched on this already, but if you were to articulate what your, say, top three or top five priorities are for your tenure as CEO, what would they be?
Well, I suppose there is a new strategic statement in place since October of last year. So there are three broad goals. One is around growth to meet that demand, I suppose, for Educate Together school places. There's also a kind of a security in growth for us. So there is a kind of a tipping point for Educate Together, a point at which become kind of properly financially sustainable and independent. And that's at around 120 schools. So when those schools are full, we'll be at a point where we possibly won't have to fundraise as much as we do at the moment. You know, a lot of our resources at the moment they're very stretched to start with, and then they have to be taken up in just, you know, looking after our financial security. So, you know, that tipping point of 120 is coming soon, but it's when those 120 schools are full and properly operating as a quality-based schools, then I think there's a kind of a breathing space which will allow for a lot of consolidation around quality, around proper support systems for the schools that are there.
Is that because you have to dedicate a lot of resources to startups?
Yeah, a lot of resources go into startups, and you know, until very recently there was almost no state funding for that work. So to get anything off the ground, it requires quite a lot of resources to get a new school off the ground when, you know, there's no building, there's no board of management, there's no, and again, the whole patron structure is based in a previous time when patrons had resources behind them in terms of parishes or trusts, religious trusts or whatever. Educate Together never had any of that. So it's pure voluntary resources you're looking at. And that requires quite a lot of support. And, it, you know, it's becoming more professional as time goes on. And we're delighted now that there is a small grant from the Department of Education for patrons who are opening new schools. But it only covers really about kind of a quarter of the cost of opening a new school. So we have been able to develop kind of a professional regional development team, but we're always fundraising to support to I suppose supplement that income. So there is that, and then I suppose the other work of being a management body and being a patron is, I mean, all schools in Ireland are underfunded, but the voluntary sector is underfunded, I suppose, to a greater extent maybe than the state sector. So you're always trying to fill those gaps. But also just as an organisation that's grown very quickly, you know, there's always a need for consolidation. The particular, I mean, what that looks like in Educate Together at the moment, we've been developing a quality framework around ethos with Dublin City University. And that's kind of coming to the end of the first stage of that process now. So we'll be implementing that with our schools over the next couple of years. That's really exciting. So looking at how do you, I suppose, assess, evaluate the extent to which your school is equality-based? It's been a really interesting question to explore, and kind of looking forward to getting that out into the schools and getting more people involved in it. And then teacher education is obviously an area as well where we probably still have a situation where most NQTs coming out of the College of Education, particularly at primary level, would feel pretty well prepared to teach in denominational primary schools, but don't always feel 100% prepared to teach ethical education because there isn't the same emphasis on it, obviously, historically. So there's certainly room for improvement there.
And from a teacher's point of view, what is different about teaching in an Educate Together school versus, say, community national school or a religious-run school?
Well, I suppose you'd have to, I haven't actually taught in an Educate Together primary school myself, so you would have to ask a teacher. But talking to teachers who, I suppose there would be some teachers who'd be particularly drawn to the sector who would talk about the fact that, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, they were drawn to the sector because maybe they identify as lesbian, gay, or transgender, bisexual, and they would feel more comfortable there. You know, there would be, and I suppose it's well documented in the research, there would be a certain feeling of maybe not feeling fully included in some religious school setting. So there would be some teachers like that. I have met, just in my work in the migrant teacher projects, teachers from immigrant backgrounds who will say, you know, I would feel more at home in an Educate Together school because people are talking about difference and they're talking about the importance of inclusion. So, you know, the equality-based ethos should extend to teachers as well. So I would like to think that teachers would feel maybe comfortable and included and respected regardless of their background or their identity. But, you know, the same could be true in lots of schools. In terms of the day-to-day practice, I would hope that it would be collaborative. I mean, we all know that that's good for inclusion and that's good for teachers. But again, you'd have to ask teachers who are actually teaching in the schools. Again, it's a diverse network. So there are many different schools within the network and teachers will be drawn to different schools for different reasons.
And looking, say, a decade ahead, what do you think are the challenges that are going to face Educate Together in the next decade or so?
I think the challenges that are facing all schools, and again, you know, very often around the educational conversations, it's not specific to the sector. Yeah, I think we all recognise we have a lot more to do in terms of children with additional needs in schools and just figuring out what that's going to look like and what's the best way of achieving what we need to achieve for those children and for all children, I think is going to be a challenge for everybody. So yeah, at the school level, there are a number of challenges like that. In terms of an organisation, as I say, resources, we'd like to get to a point of financial sustainability. At the moment, about 20% of our resources come from the state. We'd like that to increase, obviously. And then also in terms of growth, we have an objective that if there was an Educate Together school place available within half an hour of everyone in the country, then, you know, we might be able to take a breath and say, where will we go from here? So, you know, the vision is set out in the charter, equality-based education available to every child in Ireland. That's the objective.
When a board of management of an Educate Together school goes to recruit a principal of a school, what kind of qualities are they looking for in a principal, specifically as opposed to the regular teachers?
We have a policy around principal recruitment that's been developed over the years and is tweaked. No more than any kind of board of management, you're looking for the best person for that school more than the best person for an Educate Together school. So it'll depend on the community that the school is in, the needs of that particular area. I mean, when it's a startup school, you're looking for a particular set of skills, obviously, because that is a challenging role to establish a new school in this day and age with all of the responsibilities that go with that. You know, there's a particular set of skills that are needed. And then, of course, with that, you want somebody who has a particular interest in the ethos, who has an understanding of, you know, what their vision is for a quality education, of how they are going to ensure that every individual in the school community is equally respected and that, you know, everyone's educational needs are met. So I suppose these days with competency-based interview processes, you kind of think of it in terms of the list of skills and competences that are needed. And then you run the equality-based ethos. So which extends, of course, to how people are going to work with their staff, as well as how they're going to, I suppose, design the curriculum and adapt it to the needs of the local community.
And some parents who want their children to attend Educate Together schools, they also want denominational religious instruction. Is that something that's still facilitated? I know it certainly was in the past. Is that something that is facilitated in Educate Together schools?
Yes. I mean, there is still a huge demand for, in particular, preparation for the sacraments for children from Catholic backgrounds, because, of course, you know, making your communion is culturally embedded in Irish society. So of course, there's a demand for that. And we reckon that about 50% of the children attending Educate Together primary schools do come from Catholic backgrounds. So it's facilitated in different ways in different schools. Take my own son's school as an example. Preparation for communion and confirmation used to happen on Sundays in the school building. So parents would organise it. A teacher would be brought in. We would go in and open up the school and the children would have their instruction on a Sunday morning. And then they might go over to Mass as well as part of that at different times in the year. It's recently moved from that setup into the parish, which is a move that hopefully we'll see more and more of. And I was certainly personally very happy to see that happen. So what that means is children now go over to the parish centre, which is very close to the school, after school during the week. And again, a teacher is brought in to work with them, but there's also much closer liaison with people from the parish, with the priest. They're, you know, they're in the church, they're in the parish hall. And, you know, I think we'll probably see more of that in years to come, not just in Educate Together schools, but in other schools as well.
We're coming near the end, Eimear, so I have just some general questions about education that I put to all guests on the programme. And the first one is, what is school for, or what are schools for?
I love that question. I don't have an answer for it. But it's one I love to tease out with, you know, with students, different students that I'm working with. So I've been recently teaching in UCD as part of the MSc in Children and Youth Studies, a course called Equalities and Social Justice in Children's Learning. And we usually start off with that question because it's quite an international group. So you get really different perspectives and tease it out. I think it's a really important question, actually, for everyone to ask themselves regularly, including at school level. I think we should all be asking ourselves, what is school for?
But you're not going to answer
No.
it. Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, there are quite a few. I mean, I suppose like a lot of people who went into teaching, I enjoyed school, which means that, yes, you know, I can think of lots of teachers that I liked, lots of teachers that I learned different things from. You know, there's no one seminal teacher who I look back on, but there are a few. So, you know, I remember our hockey coach in secondary school, for example, you know, even in the middle of a hockey coaching session would ask these really profound questions. Yeah, I remember one day, for example, it was in the 1980s when unemployment was really high in Ireland. And she just kind of threw into conversation, it's mad, isn't it, all these people out of work and everyone who is working is working too hard. She'd just throw out those things and she'd leave you thinking about it for weeks. And it was great. But lots. No one particular teacher, but lots.
Who or what inspires you?
Again, lots of different individuals. I mean, my own parents, like everyone, I think, in different ways. They both would have been activists for equality and for human rights in their own different ways. I have a lot of time for Professor Áine Hyland, who is one of the founders of the Dawkey School Project, who I continue to learn lots from. I think she's an amazing woman. And I think those founders in the early days faced even more opposition than, you know, people campaigning for change in education these days. They really, some of what they experienced was, you know, quite appalling in terms of the resistance and, you know, the abuse that people got back in the 1970s and 80s for daring to be different. But Áine in particular always met that with such calm and such grace and, you know, in that area, but also in terms of what she's done in her own educational career. You know, the first female vice president of a university in Ireland. I have an enormous respect for Áine, and every time I meet her, she inspires me. Kathleen Lynch in UCD in equality studies, again, you know, daring to be different and developing a whole new way of thinking about equality, which, you know, has international resonance. And again, not just in her academic work, but as a person, just being incredibly personable and supportive and, yeah, I suppose daring to name power inequalities that are there in society.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
I don't. I mean, academically, I like to remember to go back to some of the kind of big ideas, people regularly enough, especially people who are writing about the influence of neoliberalism in education. So, you know, reading back over kind of Michael Apple and Henry Giroux and all of those people. But yeah, I suppose I use Twitter quite a lot, and I like, you know, flicking around on Twitter and seeing what's out there, following different people at different times. I follow the Ed Chatty hashtag, and there's usually something interesting popping up there every now and then. I haven't managed to tune into the Monday evening Ed Chatty live session recently, but I would like to get back into that because I always enjoyed that quite a lot. Simon Lewis on show.net, I would generally have a look at, but no, nothing in particular.
And what is your vision of an educated person?
Somebody, I mean, this is just thinking off the top of my head now, somebody who asks questions, who asks pertinent questions, who has the interest and the curiosity and the knowledge to ask the right questions. Yeah, that's probably it.
And finally, what from your own primary or secondary education informs your practice in education today?
Well, everything. I mean, I think everything informs everybody's practice. And I think that's one of the things we need to get better at recognising, is we come to every situation with all these influences, our family and our schools, and in particular for schools, you know, we tend to start teaching the way we were taught. So everything is the short answer. I mean, my secondary school was unusual. I went to New Park Comprehensive in Black Rock, which We were
John Harris.
Yeah. So we didn't have uniforms. Transition year was being piloted in our school before it was happening anywhere else. And again, we weren't that conscious of it at the time. We just thought, I just thought that was my school. But looking back, that was obviously formative in terms of how I think about education and what education, you know, should be.
And I want to wish Dr. Emer Nolan the best of luck in her new position as Chief Executive Officer of Educate Together, the equality-based school patron. To listen back to or download this podcast or hundreds of others, please go to seandelaney.com and click on podcasts. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That helps other educators find out about it. To write to me with feedback or suggestions, you can email insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available to borrow from all good libraries or to buy from online bookstores. You can follow me on Twitter @InsideEd. Until the same time next week, when I'll be back with another Inside Education podcast, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.